You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett from Zoomer Radio, AM 740.
Welcome aboard, friends. Good to have you with us, and hope you'll stay for the duration. So come on in, take off your jacket, sit right down, put your feet up, and enjoy the ride. As we roll on into the Christmas season, I hope wherever you are safe and warm and dry. I don't know what the weather's like where you are. Perhaps, you know, a little bit of snow would be nice before the big day. Just a little bit. As long as it clears up before, you know, we all have to hit the roads. And a lot of people traveling this time of year, so I hope your traveling goes well and it's safe. And I know Tim, my producer in the other room there, is off to Japan for the Christmas holidays. And then when you're away, I'll be in Los Angeles, leaving next Sunday, taping more interviews for the television show, Season 3 of The Conspiracy Show. In fact, my guest is going to join me here in just a moment. I'm going to join her up in Northern California, up in the Bay Area, and talk about what we're talking about tonight on the radio. We're also going to talk about it on the television for Season 3. In any event, so when I'm away in L.A., and then you're off to Japan, and then when I come back, my old producer, my very first producer here at the flagship station of our little burgeoning network here at AM 740 in Toronto, Dan Ellison will be sitting in for you, Tim. So it'll be and Tim just got back from – or Dan just got back from – I don't know where he was. He went off on the road to find himself. He was replaced by Dave Griffin, who went off to Kathmandu. Now you're going to Japan. I'd love to have your frequent flyer miles. That's all I can say. As long as we can fly, that's the thing. How long is it before they're going to clamp down and prevent us from flying? They're really trying to make it difficult as it is. But if you go to the website, richardserrett.com, where you can find out everything there is to know about The Conspiracy Show. But at richardserrett.com, I've posted a story. It's Agenda 21, What You Need to Know About UN's Global Sustainable Development Plan. There's a buzzword or a buzz phrase we're all familiar with, right? Sustainable development. Well, I've linked up to a story here. It's quite a nice one by Judy McLeod, who writes for Canada Free Press. Every household, she says, should serve up a sizable portion of Agenda 21 and what it's all about with the turkey and stuffing this Christmas. There's no better time than Christmas to reflect on your life and where loss of individual freedom is taking modern society. You don't have to go to university to become a graduate of all things Agenda 21. The only university courses on the subject are administered by the UN University of Peace in sunny Costa Rica. All you have to do is Google the United Nations and sustainable development for a chilling check on reality. While dinner's cooking, take your school-aged children outside and show them the innocuous-looking wireless smart meter attached to the outside of your house. That wireless device is a mechanism by which your local utilities commission, get this, under complete control of the UN, knows your every move, right down to how many people are in your place of dwelling. Phony pirates like Johnny Depp are only the stuff of silly movies. Teach your children non-Hollywood truth. Real-life cutthroat pirates carouse the UN. And she goes on to describe all about what this UN Agenda 21 is all about. Everything from from smart meters to it's going to impact on every aspect of our life. And this is all coming out of the UN, spearheaded back in the early 90s by President George Walker Bush, Herbert Walker Bush, I should say. Well, we're going to delve into Agenda 21 right now, and we're going to find out how this action plan to inventory and control all of the land, all of our water, our minerals, our plants, animals, construction, all means of production, information, energy, all human beings in the world. And these terms like sustainability and smart growth and high-density urban mixed-use development all comes from this UN Agenda 21. And while the UN insists it's voluntary, my guest says that's not true. We're being lied to. We're being manipulated. Rosa Corey is a forensic commercial real estate appraiser specializing in eminent domain valuation. Her 28-year career as an expert witness on land use has culminated in exposing the impacts of sustainable development on private property rights and individual liberty. In 2005, she was elected to a Citizens Oversight Committee in Santa Rosa, Northern California, to review a proposed 1,300-acre redevelopment project in which 10,000 people live and work. Her research into the documents justifying the plans led her, with her partner, to challenge the fraudulent basis for the huge Gateway redevelopment project. The city, in an attempt to block Corey from Rosa Corey from exposing the project, removed the neighborhood in which Corey and her partner's properties were located from the redevelopment area. She is the author of Behind the Green Mask, UN Agenda 21. Great pleasure to welcome Rosa Corey to The Conspiracy Show. Hello, Rosa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
In a nutshell, Agenda 21, coming out of the United Nations, what is it all about?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you laid it out. As I do say on my website, it is it's not a conspiracy theory; it's a conspiracy fact. It is the action plan, the blueprint, to inventory and control all aspects of human interaction with the environment, including all aspects of land use, water, minerals, plants, animals, education, information, construction, means of production, and information, including every way that human beings touch the planet. This is an inventory and control plan, and it is not some dusty old plan that has no impact on you. It is having an impact on you no matter where you live in the world. It was signed on to Agenda 21. Is called Agenda 21 because it's the agenda for the 21st century. That's what the UN called it. And it was signed on to by 179 world leaders, including, as you said, George H.W. Bush and Brian Mulroney in 1992. And it was brought back into our nations. It is a non-binding agreement, but because our countries implemented it, we have implemented this in our countries, and so it is binding on us because it is national. These are national laws, rules, regulations, ordinances, and acts that are implementing Agenda 21 right now. And mainly you see it as land use plans, but you also see it as controls on water and energy, your educational system, food production. It impacts every part of your life, including domestic surveillance.
I mentioned these smart meters off the top. That might be the most visible aspect of these, because anyone can go outside their house here in Ontario right now and look at these smart meters. I don't know if you have them in California.
Oh, well, sure.
Okay, mm-hmm. So how do these smart meters figure into Agenda 21?
Well, when you think about we're talking about globalization here. And globalization is the standardization of systems because, as I say, you can't control what you don't inventory. If you don't know what you have, you can't control it. So this is an inventory plan and then a control plan. So smart meters, and you have smart meters not just on your electrical meter or your gas meter, but they are metering water as well. So when you have smart meters on your water and your energy, this is a centralized control that is a smart grid that goes, it's not just in Canada or the United States, it's all around the world. I've seen smart meters in rural Mexico. This is a way to monitor, control, surveil, and manage all aspects of your life. And so this is how it ties in with smart meters, because you have a centralized control and standardization of systems. So if you're using what is perceived to be too much water, you can have your water, you can have your water limited by your meter. You can have your energy limited by your meter or shut off completely by your meter without anyone coming onto your property. And this is not some fantasy. This is real. This is the way that these meters are designed. Regardless of whether there are any health issues related to the meters themselves,
they emit EMF. Frequency. Yes, they emit EMF in a pulse, right. Like every 30 seconds.
Mm-hmm. And regardless of that issue, and I think that is a concern. But what I'm talking about here is something that is not. It's not. There's no issue as far as whether it's controversial or not. This is the reality. This is what these are designed to do: is to shut off your ability to access your water or your power.
So Agenda 21, when Canada and the U.S. signed on, so the provincial government here where I am in Ontario, they were given their marching orders from the U.N. They had no alternative but to institute this aspect of it, the smart meters. Is that right?
No, that's not exactly right. What it was this is a voluntary plan. It was signed on to by your prime minister, Brian Mulroney, and I guess I'm saying his name right. I don't know.
Yes, you are.
And in 1992. And so, you know, the thing is that the people are going to look around and say, well, I don't see the United Nations in my neighborhood. And it's true, they're not. What you have here is a plan that, because it was adopted by your country, and because your country has made laws and rules and regulations that implement it, yes, it is binding, and that's what you see. So what the United Nations is a framework, it's a structure to allow for global governance. And so this is the goal, is ultimately, we're in it right now, we're moving steadily into a corporatocracy, a totalitarian state, total globalization, and concentration of power in a very small elite. And this is the way that it happens, through land use, through control on our energy, and also through infiltration and control of our educational system.
Rosa Corey is with us, the author of Behind the Green Mask, UN Agenda 21. We'll open up the phone lines. You have questions and comments. This is something you need to know about. The UN's Global Sustainable Development Plan, how will it affect you? We'll find out more on the other side. When The Conspiracy Show continues, don't go away.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Welcome back. Rosa Corey is with us. Behind the Green Mask, UN Agenda 21. And Rosa, I was on your website, Democrats Against UN Agenda 21. And what the takeaway there for me was the UN is at war with North America. They don't like the fact that we have single-family homes. They don't like the fact that we have our own cars. They don't like our air conditioning. They don't like the fact that we eat meat. They think we're dangerous. We're a threat to the planet. Is that right?
Yeah, but it's not just North America. What this is that the middle-class lifestyle is considered to be unsustainable. You know, everyone thinks they know what sustainable development is. You know, it's like we've all heard this term now. But that comes from the United Nations in 1987, the Brundtland Commission, the UN World Commission on Environment and Development, said that sustainable development was development that meets the needs of the present without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. So, of course, then they immediately determine that, yes, everything we're doing now does compromise the ability of future generations to meet their needs. And what were they going to do about it? And this is the action plan. Agenda 21 is the action plan. And they consider to be unsustainable single-family residences, private vehicles, appliances, meat eating. Basically, this is the middle class lifestyle that many people around the world aspire to. But this is considered to be unsustainable. And so when you have identification of your homes, your private single-family homes, as being unsustainable, that is then the justification for smart growth, high-density development in the city centers and the Wildlands Project, which is to move people out of the rural and suburban areas and into the city centers. This plan is basically an ultra-urbanization plan. It's a war on rural areas, and it involves subsidies for development of high-density transit-oriented development in cities. And this is where a lot of your money is going to be going, is into these for-profit developments that are built by private developers for they're building the hardscape for your future poverty.
Rosa, here's the thing. Now, I consider myself to be, you know, kind of a rugged individualist, but some of these things, on a certain level, make sense. I mean, I'm for, you know, greater density in the urban centers with, you know, access to good transit and so forth. I mean, I think that urban sprawl really is kind of a blight. I love New York City for that very reason. You know, it's all contained on an island and great density and so forth and all the amenities that provides. As long as it's voluntary, that's the problem, though.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's it. And, you know, I agree. Of course, some people really love city living. I also have lived in high-density areas in San Francisco and really have enjoyed it. It's difficult if you want to have a dog or you have children or you have, you know, other, you know, your, let's say your sax player or whatever. You want to smoke. You can't smoke in your apartment. There are many areas now that have outlawed smoking in your condo or your apartment, in your own unit. So this is, you know, of course, if you want to live in a high-density development, that's great, but what's happening is that your property tax and your transportation tax dollars are going to subsidize these developments. And this is what's happening, is that through sustainable communities strategy grants, through many regional planning grants that are coming down through federal governments, including in Canada, you're finding that money is being diverted into these plans. And these are basically crony developer developments that projects that benefit specific individuals but have sort of a veneer of environmental concern. This is the hijacking of the environmental movement.
So they want to herd us in like cattle into the cities where we can be surveilled. We can be controlled. Now, how do they want to limit our mobility? I mean, I was mentioning off the top how, you know, it seems to me that they're trying to make it as difficult as they can for us to fly anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But how else are they, this under Agenda 21, are they attempting to limit our mobility?
Mm-hmm. Well, what you'll see, of course, is vehicle miles traveled taxes, which involves putting a GPS device on your private car and charging you if you drive too many miles. And if you think that I'm making this up, check it out. Vehicle miles traveled taxes. This is coming your way. Another thing is to take your transportation tax dollars and basically sink them into a hole called high-speed transit, high-speed rail. This is designed to fail. We don't have high-speed rail in the United States. I don't believe you have it in Canada.
No.
And it's very, very expensive. And this is a plan that is being pushed heavily. It will divert a huge amount of our transportation tax dollars. And you have to remember, this plan is about, Agenda 21 is about destroying your independence. It's about creating total dependence on government, and it's about loss of sovereignty. It's about the erasure of jurisdictional boundaries and the loss of individual sovereignty. So you may have, for instance, the North American Union, which is being facilitated by non-governmental organizations through alliances and through basically groups that will go around the treaty process so that it's not necessary to have a treaty. It's just agreements that are made by private groups that eventually will influence government enough that we won't have separate boundaries.
Now, this Agenda 21, as I understand it, goes by many different names because it's being implemented at the local level. So if someone were to, let's say they're concerned about this after hearing the show or after reading your book, Behind the Green Mask, and they want to find out to what extent it's already taking place in their community. Let's say they call the city hall and they say, well, we don't know anything about Agenda 21. Mm-hmm. What are some of the other names it may be hiding under?
Mm-hmm. You'll never see it called Agenda 21, and that's how your government can say that you're crazy and you're making it up and you're a conspiracy theorist, right? It's only just recently that the government even acknowledges, our governments even acknowledge that Agenda 21 exists and that they signed it. And even now, you will find that they don't wish to do that. But so what you're going to see, let's say you're in Calgary, you're going to see the Calgary Regional Partnership Land Use Vision of 2007. That's 18 municipalities. This is a regional vision. If you're in New York State, you'll see Plan New York City 2030, Long Island 2035. You'll see Vision 2020, Sustainable New York, Connecticut. You're going to see huge groups of municipalities, 37 municipalities in New York. That join together. You're going to have large groups of cities and counties joining together as regions that are going to basically create these regional boards that you don't elect. So what this does is it destroys your ability to influence through your government. You don't have representational government then, and you have lost your regional, your boundaries. This is what it does, is it erases your jurisdictional boundaries. So then they create sort of a parallel government that is regional, and that is the stepping stone to globalization, because that erases boundaries, and that's what globalization is all about.
How are they going to, I mean, let's face it, since the sort of the start of the Industrial Revolution, you know, in North America, going back more than 150 years, people have started to move off the farms and into the city. And that's escalated, obviously. Now the family farm is pretty well done. But for those people that are still sort of clinging to that rural life, how are they going to coerce them into the cities? Are they just going to stop maintaining their roads or providing services? How are they going to do it?
Mm-hmm. Well, that is one way. What you'll see is, for instance, if you're in a rural area, you'll see that your rural roads will not be maintained. Your rural post offices will be closed. Your rural schools will be closed. Services, basically, will be ended out in your area. And then what happens then is that infrastructure can't be supported out there. Less and less people are able to live in those areas. You have people who can't get their goods to market. And then you have vehicle miles travel taxes that are going to tax you if you're driving a long distance, and people gradually will begin to come into the cities, and then there's less money out there to maintain whatever infrastructure is left, and this is how it's done. So this is, you may think, water well monitoring is one way they do it as well. You know, you may think that you're out there, you're self-sufficient, and then someone comes out from your government and says that they're going to put a meter on your water well and restrict your use of water.
How can they come onto private property and put a, I mean, the smart meter goes right up on your house in many mm-hmm. instances. How can they do that legally?
Yeah, well, you know, you have basically an easement on your property for the utility if you look at your deed. And that's what they're saying, you know, that they basically have the right to, you know, to utilize that easement and come onto your property. What's necessary to do is to object, to reject smart meters and object as a group. So you want to go to your local, you know, whether you're in a city or county or whatever, wherever you are, you want to get down there, you want to make a lot of noise and say you do not want smart meters. And, you know, if you're like us in California, we have opted out. We have to pay to not have a smart meter on our property that supposedly is to have it monitored, have someone come out and read it. But you can do that. And if you don't have that option, you should demand that option, because we want to block this as long as we possibly can.
Rosa Corey is with us. Behind the Green Mask, UN Agenda 21, and the website is Democrats Against UN Agenda 21. Now, Rosa, this... As they're herding people out of the rural areas into the major urban centers, And I believe you call it stack and pack housing, and restricting our mobility and creating these regional governments without representation. What are they going to do with this vast areas that are being abandoned?
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, remember, they're not really being abandoned. Control is being taken of these areas through non-governmental organizations, NGOs, land trusts, and your government. So, for instance, if you want to take a look at our website, we have the North American Wildways on there, which is from the Wildlands Network. And they show, and that's actually in my book, too, they show it's incredible the amount of area. In fact, most of Canada is in this thing called the Arctic Boreal, which is a wild way, and the spine of the continent, which goes from Central America all the way up into Alaska, runs right through the middle western middle of the United States, right up into Canada. These are the wild ways. The Spine of the Continent Initiative is part of a plan to actually remove human beings from this huge swath that includes portions of many states and huge portions of Alberta and BC and up into the Yukon. This is the Yukon to Yellowstone plan. So the plan is to basically move human beings out of these so-called wilderness areas and allow them to be wild as they were, you know, prior to human beings being on the planet. And this is the this is the story. This is the green mask. That's why I call my book Behind the Green Mask. You know, because this is the idea, is that you're going to be, you know, so cool. You're going to release this land to the animals.
Well, yeah, I mean, but it's interesting. If you look at the lineage of a lot of these environmental movements, you scratch beneath the surface. Let's look at the World Wildlife Fund, for example, which was founded by Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, who was a former SS officer, and, of course, Prince Philip, who once said that if he was reincarnated, he'd like to come back as a deadly human virus. These are not nice people behind these movements.
I know, that's great. Can you imagine? He actually was recorded saying that. Yeah, so the idea then is that human beings are a blight on the planet and should be removed. But really what this is about taking control of land, water, oil and gas, timber, and moving that out of a single individual's property ownership. This is about transfer of property ownership from private ownership to public and ultimately then to the non-governmental organizations.
Well, here in Canada, it's the Crown, right? The Queen, she owns it.
Right. Yeah, you have Crown land there. And I think isn't something like 89% of Canada is Crown land or federal land?
Yes. I mean, if you look on your deed, unless you specifically alter your deed when you, I guess, you buy your property, the mineral rights and everything do not belong to you underneath your house.
Mm-hmm.
You don't even own your house. You've got a long-term lease. I mean, it's all the Queen's land. It's all Crown land. Anyway, Rosa, we'll take a time out. We'll come back. We'll continue to delve into Agenda 21. This is a nightmare, folks. Stay tuned.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
And Rosa Corey is with us behind the green mask. We're talking about Agenda 21. And I was reading a Forbes magazine, Rosa, and they were talking about these land barons, people like media moguls like John Malone and Ted Turner and billionaire Stan Kroenke. I mean, these three individuals alone own nearly 10 million acres. They are the largest individual landowners in the United States. Now, the thing is, I recall Ted Turner talking about, you know, wanting to, before he dies, he's gonna donate the bulk of his estate to the United Nations. I'm wondering, I mean, is he part of this rewilding program to turn over this land? He's buying up ranch land?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he is. It's funny because Ted Turner, he's all about, there's too many people and, he was talking about cannibalism at one point. He has five kids himself. But of course, these people are all hypocrites. That has nothing to do with it, right, as far as they're concerned. He's doing, he's releasing wild carnivores onto his land, wolves, bears, And this is something that you're seeing, you know, more and more wild carnivores coming into cities and populated areas, because, you know, this is the idea, is to bring back carnivores into the wild. And so you're seeing this with, especially with property owners who have large tracts of land, who are, you know, buying into this philosophy, because the idea is to get people out of those areas as much as possible. And animals, you know, don't know where the boundaries are. So, for instance, you know, I want to refer to this one thing that's, it's called Two Countries, One Forest. It's the United States and Canada, five states, four provinces, up in the northern Appalachians and in eastern Canada. It's 80 million acres. And this is, you know, the idea is that this is, you know, this is going to be sort of a large area that is protected for animals. And the World Resources Institute has something called the Global Forest Watch, where they have a NASA satellite go over every 16 days. And what this does is it identifies every single tree, not just identifies that the tree exists, but identifies the species of the tree as well. So when you have a conservation easement over your property, or restrictions on what you can do on your property, this is land that's being surveilled from the air through a NASA satellite every 16 days. So this is part of, you know, large landowners are giving huge amounts of money to non-governmental organizations like World Wildlife Fund and Natural Resources Defense Council, and are regulating the way that land is being used and who is going to be able to use it.
Once they herd everyone into the cities, and in if they're doing away with a lot of these, you know, the family farm and so forth, how are the people in the cities going to be fed? Is that where the GMOs come in?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's, well, you know, if you really start looking into this and you look at food sheds, which is something I talk about in my book as well, the idea of, you know, this go local thing, it sounds so cool. Go local. Of course you want to go local, right? Who doesn't want to buy local food? But the idea ultimately is that if you can't get it locally, you're not going to be eating it. So if you can't grow it in what's called a food shed, which is an area that is within, let's say, 100 miles of your high-density urban transit village, then you don't get to eat it. And then ultimately you would imagine, extrapolate from that, that that if you can't get enough food for, you know, let's say you figure 2,000 calories a person, that would determine the population, allowable population of that transit village area. And this is something, I'm not making this up. If you go take a look at Cornell University and food sheds, you'll see this. So one of the things that, of course, you're going to see as well as in terms of food is that if you can't get access to it locally, then you're not going to have it. So they're talking about vertical farms. And that basically means you'll be farming in a parking garage, you know, a structure. And they haven't figured out how to get enough light into the center of those structures. But that's the concept. So you're, you know, and think about the mold and all that. But that's the idea, is to everyone being self-sufficient. This is the concept. You know, the sort of all of these totalitarian plans require, you know, the vision of the glorious future. They also require the Spartan present, austerity measures now, but they have the vision of the glorious future, and that is, you know, that is what all of this is predicated on.
Starting to sound a lot like Soylent Green, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, so this, so you mentioned the austerity measures, and so is the economic. Well, I hear the music creeping up here, so we'll get to this when we come back. But I want you to talk about this when we come back, Rosa. This current economic a downturn, is that by design? Is that part of sort of acclimatizing us for the lean years that are coming? This a permanent depression, perhaps? We'll get to that as we continue to discuss Agenda 21, what you need to know about the UN's Global Sustainable Development Plan, with Rosie Corey. Back with more.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Welcome back. Rosa Corey is with us behind the green mask, UN Agenda 21. Before we get to that economic question and whether this current downturn, prolonged recession, is part of Agenda 21. And in other words, was it engineered? Let's get to the phones. Rudy has been patient and is waiting on the line from Toronto. Rudy, welcome to the Conspiracy Show. Yes. Go ahead. Hi there.
Thank you. Hi. Well, environmentalists and animal rights people, they care about the planet, and there's always some people trying to say they have a hidden agenda. Well, they don't. If the UN recognizes the damage that the humans have done to the planet, then that's a good thing. And animals are coming into our cities because we are encroaching onto their territory. We're leaving less and less room for them. So what's wrong with having safe corridors for animals to live in?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's... Okay, that's a nice idea. Safe corridors is great. I don't know if you've taken a look at the North American Wildways Project, but that is roughly two-thirds of Canada, most of the west coast of the United States, down through the central spine of the U.S., and then on the eastern part of the United States and Canada as well. So what we're talking about here is not just, you know, leaving some area for animals. What we are talking about is putting human beings in tightly controlled, very small, high-density mega cities. This is the plan, is to move people out of rural and suburban areas into high-density areas where their mobility will be restricted. This is not really about making it so that Bambi and Bambo can get together. This is really about restricting our ability to move freely through our world. And this is also to be able to make it so that surveillance is more efficient. And this is part of the plan, is to surveil, manage, and monitor human beings. So, yeah, you know, this has a green face. If it didn't, you would never be going for it.
All right, Rudy, welcome. Thanks for the call. Let's go to Brampton now, and Brampton, Ontario, and say hello to Beverly. Welcome to the Conspiracy Show, Beverly.
Hello.
Hi there.
I believe in this Agenda 21. It has been happening for a long while now, because in Jamaica, my grandparents, they live like far out in the rural, and some people came in and took them out of their land and put them in the town. So this thing has been happening for a long while now.
Are you concerned about it, Beverly?
Yeah, I am concerned.
Mm-hmm. All right, so it's already she's already experienced this firsthand in places like Jamaica. People being mm-hmm. forcibly removed. I mean, that happens. I'm guessing let's say the developing world far more than we realize.
Well, one reason why you'll see that is because carbon sinks are being developed in the third world, second world areas, developing world areas. These are essentially forests that are being planted or lands that are so-called being conserved that actually have people living on them who are being forcibly removed in order to create these multi-billion dollar areas that are considered to be carbon sinks, and then they can on carbon trading on carbon exchanges these can be traded shares in these can be traded in order to offset pollution in developed and developing nations. So I have seen this recorded. In fact, if you go to the New York Times and put in Uganda and carbon sinks, you'll find an article about a whole villages that are being burned down so that forests could be created for carbon sinks. So this is something that's going on any time that you see huge corporations involved in trading of carbon credits. You're going to see abuses of rural people.
Yeah, it seems like what's behind this is, again, it's maybe under the auspices of the UN, but you have certain very powerful individuals, maybe you might find them at a Bilderberg meeting, who want to institute a new feudal society.
Yes.
So that the plebs will be living in these ghettos. And meanwhile, they'll have these vast, tracts of land where they can do their hunting and fishing and, just back in it, as it was during the medieval times. And if one of the plebs got caught, hunting on the lord's land, there was hell to pay. Is that what they want, a new feudal society?
Yeah, that's actually what I call it, is neo-feudalism. And this is an engineered economic collapse because the goal is to create total dependence on government and ultimately to have the governments themselves, local and county and provincial governments, to be dependent on federal funds. And by that I mean when you have sustainable community strategy grants and regional planning grants that are coming down from your federal government, then they are dictating how development will happen in cities and county areas. And this is part of the goal, is to create total dependence so that all of these grants are, you know, these cities and counties are desperate for funds, so they will go along when they're required to have, for instance, priority development areas or urban growth boundaries. Now, you know, what we're talking about here is costing billions of dollars in implementation. And it's not that I'm against the idea of high-density development, as I said. What I'm talking about is that your tax dollars are going to subsidize this, and this money is being diverted to public-private partnerships, where your government is actually, you are actually underwriting projects that are hugely expensive and have very little relationship with what the market demand is. And so this is how the markets are collapsed, and this is what's happened to us. We are in a depression.
I believe so. I believe so. I think, yeah, I think were it not for you know, certain programs that are now in place, I mean, things would be are far worse than they would be during the Depression in terms of the numbers of unemployed and chronically underemployed. Jerry is in Pennsylvania. Welcome to the Conspiracy Show, Jerry.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. You wanted to talk about electricity monopolies.
Yeah, in Pennsylvania, they have about over 40 different electric companies, And you're supposed to pick the person with the cheapest rates, and it gets real confusing when there's so many electric companies fighting for the one customer. You know what I'm saying?
So are you saying that you would welcome something like Agenda 21?
No.
I'm not quite sure what your point is, Jerry.
The monopolies make it that if you want the electricity is actually higher in price because of the monopolies.
Mm-hmm. Well, what I'm seeing with electricity is that you have community choice aggregation, which is coming your way, which means that your local government goes into the power business and either subsidizes solar or wind, and there are no limits on what they can charge you for that. The Department of Energy in the United States wants 20% wind energy by 2030, and they have an aggressive renewables plan. So, and by 2011, only about 3% of total electricity was from wind, for instance. So there's huge cash grants going, and billions of dollars in tax credits. And this is another way that, you know, obviously they confuse the consumer. We have situations where, in fact, your renewables are not really, let's say you're selling back to the power grid, you're not actually using your own power. And it's very hard to establish yourself as being off the grid now. And this is something that is being used as a manipulation, because power is a huge amount of there's a huge amount of money and power and a huge amount of subsidies that are your tax dollars going to a few producers who are making a huge amount of money on this.
Someone came up to my mother-in-law's house and wanted to rent her roof to put a solar panel on there to sell it back to the utility, and they're getting grants from the government to do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's all kinds of schemes out there now. It's sort of the new little scheme. The thing that you know, that I think is really fascinating is carbon credits, because you have manufacturers that are earning huge, you know, millions of dollars by churning out gases, harmful greenhouse gases, so they can be paid to destroy the waste byproduct. They're cashing in on carbon credits, and that's something that China is doing. And so, you know, this is this is something we're seeing with cap and trade. You know, the transition, the monetization of carbon, and restrictions on use. And this is, you know, all these things sound good, but really, when you look behind it, what it is it's a green mask, and it's being used to create this crash economy that we're all living with.
Let's get Sandy in here. Sandy, welcome to the Conspiracy Show. Where are you calling from?
Calling from Toronto. Thank you very much.
All right, go ahead, please.
Yeah, just listen to it. I've been studying these things for a number of years, a number of decades. I've also lived in community up in the somewhat north of Toronto here, and now I'm back in the city in a transition period in my life, and I'm just asking some really tough questions, doing some studying of propaganda and talking to people, and I'm into organic gardening myself. So I'm just wondering, Rosa and Richard there, what would be some of the ways to stem the tide? And if you're going to leave the city, where can we go to be involved with other people that are like-minded in community?
This is a great point to sort of leave off on, Rosa, is how do we fight this? You say we are the resistance, so how do we resist?
Yeah, and I'd love to really address that that question more, because I'll tell you, there is no safe place, there is nowhere to go. You stay and fight where you are. And if you're thinking of going out into the country and being able to establish yourself there, I'm telling you, you are going to have a target on you if you're in the rural and suburban areas. So the thing that we want to do now, and I do have about 20 pages in my book, it's a short book, on what you can do. So awareness is the first step in the resistance, and you are the resistance. So you want to educate yourself. We have flyers on our websites that you can print out. They're two-sided flyers and distribute. You want to don't hand them to people. You want to put them on doorsteps early in the morning. You can get 100 of them out in about an hour. You want to get this information to people. There's no white horse, no hero is going to come along for you. So you want to dominate government meetings, video government meetings. When you go to government meetings for regional plans where they ask you to come on down and give your opinion on this cool new plan in the center of our town, that is a Delphi meeting. It is designed, it's a mind control meeting designed to direct you to a predetermined outcome. You want to refuse to comply with that, and we show you how to anti-Delphi a meeting. You want to speak out at your professional organizations, attorneys, architects, appraisers, realtors. You want to not comply with Agenda 21. You want to expose collaborators, and you need to get more information. I can't, you know, this is, there's a lot of great information out there. We invite you to check out our website, which is democratsagainstunagenda21.com. It's a nonpartisan fight. It's, this is something that freedom is totally nonpartisan. This is a worldwide fight. You want to withdraw your financial support from non-governmental organizations. If you're volunteering for nonprofits, you need to find out who they are, who's behind them, whether they support sustainable development, and whether they understand what they're doing. Colleges, universities, your educational system is imbued with this from pre-kindergarten to post-grad. You want to call it out. You want to defend and support others who are losing their land to regulations and restrictions, and you want to educate your elected officials. You want to assist people in being able to refuse federal grants, because they have been indoctrinated by the American Planning Association and other associations that are telling them that we are conspiracy theorists. That is not true. This is not a theory. This is real. And we are fighting this all over the world. We will win, but we need to get everybody on board together, working together to stop United Nations Agenda 21 sustainable development.
Rosa, thank you again. The website is democratsagainstunagenda21.com. I've linked up to it on my website, richardserrett.com. I look forward to meeting you up in the Bay Area in the next week or so, and we'll talk about this for the TV show as well. Rosa, great pleasure.
Thanks so much. I had a great time. Thank you.
Rosa Corey, Behind the Green Mask. And the website here, www.richardserrett.com.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Hello, radio friends and family. Welcome aboard The Conspiracy Show. We're nicely into the Christmas season, so, what happens during the Christmas season, of course, people flying off in all directions, madly off in all directions. Tim, I know you're going to Japan. You're flying to Japan, my producer on the other side of the glass, to spend some time with your girlfriend's family. And I'm off to L.A. next Sunday, working steadily still on season 3 of the Conspiracy Show television program. We'll have an announcement soon when that's finally going to air. It's been kind of a long gestation period, but it's going to be worth it. We've got some great episodes for you fans of the television program. And then the following week, in a couple of weeks, my old producer, my very first producer here at AM 740, where we do our flagship station here in Toronto, Dan Ellison is coming back. That was like 3 producers ago. Tim, you're my 4th producer in just over 3 years. Anyway, people coming and going, but great to have you aboard. And I don't know if it's snowing where you are, if you're in the Christmas mood, but nevertheless, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and all the best of the holiday season. We're gonna talk the paranormal over the next hour, but we're gonna sort of cover off both ends of the spectrum. A little bit later, my good friend Bob Curran, from Northern Ireland, will drop by to talk about American vampires. What's Christmas without vampires, Tim? I mean, seriously. American vampires, though, as opposed to their Eastern European sort of nobility cousins. They're always, you know, counts and barons over in Romania, but when you get to the States, they're just angst-ridden teens. That's the type of garden variety vampire you have over here. Anyway, my next guest, or my first guest, actually, no stranger to the vampire beat, but tonight we're going to cover off something a little more in tune with the Christmas season. We're going to talk angels, and she's written a major tome on this subject, the Encyclopedia of Angels, which is, I'm not sure how many printings it's into now, probably a half dozen or so. We'll find out. Rosemary Ellen Guiley, our paranormal investigator extraordinaire, joins me the second Sunday of every month, and she's here now to talk angels. Rosemary, how are you?
Hello, Richard. I'm doing quite well, and I just have to chuckle at having vampires and angels on one of your Christmas programs. I guess, after you've suffered the vampires, you can call on the angels for help.
That's right. Well, listen, when you mentioned to me earlier in the week that you wanted to talk about angels, I pulled off the shelf your Encyclopedia of Angels. I have your second edition. And how did you get interested in angels, first of all?
Angels were actually one of the first kinds of paranormal experiences I had when I was a kid. And I often felt surrounded by angels when I played or when I was going to sleep at night. And I knew they had wings and they could sing very prettily and I could hear them sing. And I thought everybody experienced angels. But children often have a lot of experiences that they think happen to everyone, and when they get older, they discover that they're rather unique. And, of course, as a lot of people get older, the experiences they had as a kid sort of fade away. For me, I was very intrigued by the paranormal. I loved the mystery of the unknown and the unseen. And as I got older, I really wanted to find out more about angels and who are they really, and do they really appear to children? Do they really help people solve their problems and crises, deliver messages from God? And they are real. I've had many angel experiences since then.
It's interesting, though, Rosemary, because as you describe in the introduction to your Encyclopedia of Angels, you growing up, you had no particular religious upbringing, no indoctrination. And so it's, for someone like yourself to have an encounter with angels, rather interesting.
You know, they're deeply ingrained in our culture. And, of course, when I was a kid at Christmas time, I loved all the trappings of Christmas. And you get out the decorations with the angels and you sing Christmas carols about angels. So they're part of life. And it's true, I didn't have any strong religious training. I was raised a Methodist, and my parents sent me to Sunday school. And
same here, Methodist, United Church, we called it up here.
Well, actually, you know, it's I think it's a good background to have because it enabled me to feel free to explore. I didn't have a lot of strong education about, beliefs that were and were not possible. And Methodism enabled me to expand quite a bit. And I ultimately felt that Christianity could not answer all of my spiritual questions and needs. In fact, there really wasn't any faith on the planet that I thought provided adequate answers to everything for everyone.
And did these encounters with angels continue throughout your life? Do you continue to see angels?
Yes. And in fact, the more, after I got older and I really started pursuing my studies on the paranormal as a young adult, the more I went into all aspects of the paranormal, the more experiences I had. I was very open, and I also took a lot of training in how to develop my psychic abilities as well. And I think when you focus your attention on something like this, it attracts to you those very things. So my inquiries about angels and my desire to know them and know more about them literally brought more angels into my life.
And what did they look like? You mentioned that they, you know, they had wings and they had beautiful voices. Were they male, female? Were they androgynous? What did they look like?
The experiences that I had when I got older, none of them have had wings. And in fact, most of the people I've interviewed about their experiences, the angels are more like pillars of light. And that's how I experience them, whether I sense them and could see them with the inner eye or whether I had visual experiences. It's a very intense light, and when I've seen them visually, the light is so bright that I can't even look at it directly. You have to avert your eye and sort of see them out of your peripheral vision. Even though it did not have a human shape, I knew they were angels, and people know that they know that this is some sort of divine being. And if it communicates telepathically, they will announce themselves. They will give a name. And you know that they are angels and why they are making themselves present. Well, our biblical ancestors had a much different attitude toward angels. They were definitely God's messengers and would take prayers to God and bring the answers back. But they were also God's disciplinarians.
Yes, people. And, I mean, people were in fear. I mean, an angel appeared before you and you trembled.
Absolutely, because you just felt that, well, God's unhappy with me, and now He's sent an angel to take me to task. And today we have a much different attitude. If an angel appears, it's a good thing. It's help. Angels are very important to our spiritual understanding. They really help connect us to the divine, which is very abstract and in many respects unknowable. But angels, who we consider to be in our likeness or similar to us, we can relate to them. And so they are a way for us to know the divine better. And every culture has them. Whether they're called angels, which are unique to the Judeo-Christian and Islamic faiths, they're called something else, you know, another name in other traditions, but their function remains the same.
And is there a hierarchy, as was sort of explained to me during my catechism, into the Orthodox faith? Is there, like, you know, you have the seraphim and different levels of angels?
I do believe there is. And in fact, we've always experienced angels that way. The ancients considered the earth to be a microcosm of the macrocosm. So things in heaven are mirrored on earth, and what goes on earth is mirrored in heaven. So if we have hierarchies and organizations and governments and that sort of thing on earth, we've always expected the heavenly realms, the cosmos, to be organized the same way. Now, the nine-tier system that most people are familiar with, the angels, the archangels, the powers, virtues, and so on, that's only one of many systems. There have been other hierarchies that were conceived even in ancient times, and they were the product of visionary experiences. So ultimately, do we know which hierarchy is the right one, so to speak? They're probably all right in some way because they are the product of visionary experiences and our attempts as human beings to organize our experiences and make sense of them. But bottom line is, yes, there does seem to be differentiations in the angels and their interests in the earth and the things that they are concerned with. The beings that we consider to be so very powerful, the angels themselves, are actually at the lowest level of the tier. And the ones at the highest level, and actually it makes quite a bit of sense, are very close to God, and their purpose is oriented toward singing the praises of God, holding the cosmic energy together through divine love.
Do you think there's a connection
with things on a much higher sphere?
Sure. Is there a connection? Oh, I want to ask you about it, if there's a possible connection between the UFO phenomena and angels, because you know, some people have who've had an encounter with ETs or UFOs seem to be describing, in my mind anyway, you know, they describe these Nordic-looking, almost human-type figures. To me, these sound like angels. What do you think?
There's quite a bit of similarity, and in fact, I think this shows our attempts at labeling perhaps even the same kind of experience. You know, we have these extraordinary experiences with beings that are quite real and very profound, and then we have to make sense out of them. So we do it the best way we can according to our time and place and culture. But a few years ago, I actually did an informal but very interesting experiment with a psychologist friend of mine. We were both officers in the International Association for the Study of Dreams. And I had noticed in the dream literature descriptions of both ETs and angels that sounded the same. So how would you know whether you were having an encounter with ETs or with angels? So I did a deeper study on it from extending beyond dreams into the encounter literature in general. And I found that if you took out the labels, ET or angel, and you asked people to identify the kind of being somebody was having a dream about or an experience with, you got both answers. That, you know, people evaluated what they were reading against what they were familiar with.
Right, superimposing
and,
their own.
So one could be transposed over the other. So how do you make some sort of sense of that? It certainly doesn't negate either one, either ETs or angels, just that there are beings that we come into contact with who have forms of light or are very bright, humanoid but very bright, and they come in mysterious ways and for the purpose of helping people. So I think we have a lot of extraordinary assistance out there, however it comes and however we label it. They certainly would all be considered part of God's plan.
And of course, at Christmas time, we like to think that we're sort of in closer connection with angels and whoever's out there listening, I hope and pray that you will you'll be speaking with your angel over this Christmas, blessed Christmas season and Hanukkah season. Rosemary, always a pleasure. And the Encyclopedia of Angels, available to book buyers at Amazon and good bookstores everywhere.
And my website, visionaryliving.com, has some articles about angels as well.
Excellent. Well, we'll direct people there. Merry Christmas, Rosemary.
Merry Christmas to you too, Richard. Look forward to seeing you again in the new year.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it as well. All right, back with American Vampires, their true bloody history from New York to California when The Conspiracy Show continues.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
Welcome back. And as I said before the break, we're moving from angels to vampires, complete opposite end of the spectrum. And what better time to talk about vampires than Christmas, am I right? Well, perhaps not. But, you know, there's no accounting for the timing in the book publishing industry. However, delighted to have Dr. Bob Curran on the program live from County Down in Northern Ireland, well-versed in the legend of the vampire. After leaving school at 14, he worked in a number of jobs, including a grave digger, which perhaps led him to his current literary career. Aside from digging graves, he worked as a lorry driver, a professional musician, a journalist, even wrote for stand-up comedians, traveled extensively, later went to the university, where he obtained a degree in education, history, and still teaches now and again. But his impressive list of books, my gosh, it goes on and on and on here, but a couple of the more popular titles: Bloody Irish, Great Irish Vampire Stories, The Truth About the Leprechaun, Celtic Lore and Legend, Meet the Gods, Heroes, Kings, Fairies, Monsters, and Ghosts of Yore, Vampires, again, A Field Guide to the Creatures That Stalk the Night, Encyclopedia of the Undead, A Field Guide to Creatures That Cannot Rest in Peace, and Zombies, A Field Guide to the Walking Dead, and his latest, as I mentioned, is entitled American Vampires, Their Bloody True History from New York to California, Dr. Bob Curran.
Dr. Bob Curran, how are you, my friend?
How are you, Richard? How are things in Toronto?
As I was saying earlier, it's beginning to feel a lot like Christmas. We don't traditionally associate the holiday season with vampires. Nevertheless, you've written this beautiful tome, blood-splattered epic here, entitled American Vampires, Their True Bloody History from New York to California, which is interesting that you're bringing it to the Western, to the New World, because we associate vampires traditionally, you know, going back to Bram Stoker and so forth, with Eastern European noblemen in black capes and so forth. So why did you decide to focus on the North American species, if I can use that term?
Okay, Richard, you have touched slightly on the reasons why. Because we begin to think of vampires as you say, noblemen in black capes and with pale faces somewhere in Eastern Europe, or angst-ridden teenagers somewhere in Middle America. But what I wanted to do was begin to look at the cultural background to some of the vampires. Not all vampires are noble men, and not all vampires are young, angst-ridden teenagers. So what I wanted to do was look at a wide spectrum of vampires, because vampires come in all shapes and sizes, depending on the culture in which they originate. And where better than where many cultures have fused together? You have Native American, you have Scots-Irish, you have Creole, you have French, you have Dutch, all Italian, all coming together in a sort of rich cultural stew, if I can use that phrase. And where better to do that than in America? So what I wanted to look at was how vampires are different in various parts of America, and look at the wide spectrum. Because Dutch vampires on the East Coast are different from Spanish vampires on the West Coast, and perhaps Scots-Irish traditional vampires in North Carolina, and Gullah vampires in South Carolina, because North Carolina and South Carolina vampires are completely different.
So America.
So that gives me a bit of space to work, and whenever I fired the book off, I said, here's a book, and the publisher said, we will do it, and we will release it for Halloween. So that's what they have done.
And so even for the undead, America is a melting pot.
Oh, very much so, because, as I say, the cultures have influenced the horrors that we experience. For example, as I've already said, North Carolina is different from, let's say, South Carolina.
Sure.
Because the culture is different. The Appalachian Mountains and through some of the mountains in North Carolina have been settled by Ulster Scots or Scots-Irish settlers, people who came from my part of the world and from Scotland.
Now
and settled all through the mountains, and they brought their own nightmares with them. For instance, you will find something like a vampire whale. Now, not all vampires, of course, are human in either shape or in nature. So you have, for example, a vampire whale, which actually comes from my part of the world. We have what are called over here famine whales. Hmm. Now, these are, let's say, whales which people have drunk from during the Great Famine of 1846 to 1852. And if you drink from them, they will draw the goodness from you rather than you drawing the water in. So that's part of the culture of the Scots-Irish.
Now, the subtitle of the book, Bob, Their True Bloody History, From New York to California. When you say their true bloody history, are you suggesting some vampires may not be human? In other words, those people who like to pretend that they're vampires, vampire cults, that there actually may be real paranormal-type vampires?
Well, the vampire is, Richard, whichever way you want to look at it, the vampire is the embodiment of some of our fears. The vampire is the fear of what happens to us after death, for example. Can we survive? Do we come back? And if so, in what form? And if we do, how do we keep survive? And that varies from culture to culture. Now, there are people, certainly, who place themselves into cults or imagine themselves to be blood-drinking vampires. Now, that is how they deal with the world around them. But what I'm looking at in the book is a cultural background where the peoples have settled in various parts of the world. And that's why I've thrown in the word history, because people have settled, and various types of people have settled all over America. And that's why I chose America, because it's such a rich melting pot. People have settled all over America from various cultural backgrounds, groups of people, and they have brought their horrors and nightmares with them, and these translate into American lore and American tradition and American folklore.
To what extent was the vampire in North America used, I guess, as an explanation or a metaphor for the spread of disease, things like tuberculosis?
That is a very good point, Richard, because, for example, if I were to ask you the vampire capital of America, you might say New York, you might say California. I would tend to say that it was the smallest state. It was Providence, or it was Rhode Island, and around Providence and places like that. And those were areas where disease spread quickly among incomers and colonists and people like that. And it became interpreted. The notion of the vampire serves to some extent in a cultural context as an interpretation for what's happening to the community. So if people go down, and you're quite right to identify tuberculosis, because tuberculosis gives the impression of a white marble skin. You may cough up blood when you sleep, so you have blood around your mouth, and you experience the sensation of a weight on your chest as your lungs try to cope with breathing. And this gives the impression that something has been in your bedroom, that something has climbed on your chest, and that something has dropped blood around your mouth or whatever. And so vampirism, particularly in the New England colonies, where disease such as tuberculosis, cholera, and places and sicknesses like that were commonplace, served as a explanation for the spread of disease. And we have the ideas of the vampire ladies of Rhode Island, which extend back from the 1700s right up until the end of the 1800s, with Nellie, the last one being Nellie Vaughan, and then Vermont and in Connecticut.
What kind of was there any sort of similarity or parallels to the witch trials that took place in terms of this paranoia and people would suspect someone of being a vampire?
Yeah, not so much in America, Richard, but certainly that was always the case in Europe. And when disease struck, even in the early colonies in America on the East Coast, people began to look around for some sort of scapegoat. People said, why is this happening to us? Is there some sort of monster? And out of European lore, they began to identify monsters among themselves, whether these were witches or vampires. Now, in places like New Mexico and some of the southwestern states, there is very little differentiation between witches and vampires. In fact, in these places and among the Native American peoples of Arizona, witches and vampires tend to be something the same. And in order to be a vampire, you do not necessarily have to be dead.
Oh, that's interesting.
You can be a witch and by day, and you can be a vampire by night. All you have to do, Richard, is open up your skin and a ball of light comes out. Now, the ball of light is the vampire. That doesn't necessarily drink blood. That drinks energy by a form of osmosis. So it can hover outside your house, and as they say, it can draw the good from the house or from the family within.
That's interesting. Bob, listen, we'll take a time out. I think a lot of us are familiar with the concept of energy vampires. Some of us may even have some in our family. But Bob Curran is on the line. We'll talk about American vampires when the Conspiracy Show continues. Don't go away.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
And we are back with Dr. Bob Curran. He visits the Louisiana bayous, the back streets of New York City, the hills of Tennessee, the Sierras of California, the deserts of Arizona, and many more locations in a bid to track down the vampire creatures that lurk there. It's all in his new book, American Vampires, Their True Bloody History from New York to California. Just in time for Christmas, you've all got a goth who's, you know, expecting something under the tree this year. So there you go. So we're talking about, this is fascinating. I didn't realize that according to the lore, even if you're not dead, you could be a vampire. And you were describing a witch. They would open up their skin and let out this ball of energy, and that ball of energy was a vampire.
That's true, because not all vampires are human, but they can actually draw, even in human form. It was thought among, let's say, the Navajo, that they could draw energy from people with whom they were sitting or with whom they were eating or with whom they were working. And maybe, Richard, you have experienced people, the concept of energy vampires is well known, but maybe you have experienced people with whom you are working who left you incredibly tired and listless.
Oh, yes.
If you like. Now, I would say these people are very, I couldn't say these people are very boring, but there was a belief among certain people that these people could, even almost unconsciously, draw the energy from you and reinvigorate themselves, if you wanted. And certainly this was part of witchcraft in the Southwest and among some of the Native American peoples, where vampires went about and drew a leeched off other members of their community or people whom they encountered.
Now, it's interesting when going back to a point we made earlier on how the vampire in Eastern Europe has been associated with noblemen. Part of that was sort of transplanted in America, too. You talk about in Massachusetts how the vampire is associated with class and social status. Tell me more about that.
Absolutely. Perhaps not in the question of nobility as we think of in Eastern Europe, but perhaps in a division between those who have and those who may have less. For example, in Cape Ann, on the Massachusetts coastline, as you quite rightly say, near the settlement of Gloucester, there was an element or a settlement which was known as Dogtown. Now, the name Dogtown appears in a number of small settlements all over the West and all in a sort of deprecatory fashion. And this was the case in Cape Ann, where there were rather colorful and eccentric people. Many were the widows of Gloucester fishermen who had died at sea. Others were people who had fallen on hard times. And the community was divided simply between the people in Gloucester, the rich merchants of Gloucester, if you like, down in the town, and Dogtown, which was up on the heights, which was full of, as it was thought, ne'er-do-well. And vagabonds and people who were of lesser social status than those. And there were people, and they're mentioned in the book, who had from time to time very strange looking teeth, very long teeth. And it was simply a physical characteristic. But they became equated with blood drinkers, that up in Dogtown there was nothing but witchcraft and the old women. And some of the old women survived by telling fortunes. Some of them survived by giving out love charms and stuff like that. So Dogtown, because of its low social status, became equated with witchcraft and with evil doing and with people with long teeth. And there were several of them, because there was a rather eccentric dentist up there who pulled Captain John Morgan Stanley, who pulled teeth very strangely. They became acquainted with vampires, and it was thought that some of them traveled about at night in the guise of bats and the birds, and drank from the decent, upstanding, socially better off people in Gloucester and around the Cape and headland.
That's why Governor Romney looked so pale during the campaign.
You may know that. I may know that, but I couldn't possibly comment.
Bob, let's take a time out. We'll come back. More questions for Bob Curran as we discuss American vampires here on The Conspiracy Show. Stay with us.
You're listening to an exclusive podcast of The Conspiracy Show with Richard Serrett. Heard every Sunday night from 11 p.m. to 1 a.m. on Zoomer Radio, the new AM 740.
We're back for a few minutes with Bob Curran. The book is American Vampires, and it's their true bloody history from New York to California. You know, you're describing those people that were accused of being vampires. It obviously leads to the whole discussion, the idea of the vampire based on the concept of difference. So if an outsider, for example, would be more inclined, I guess, to be in other parts of the country perhaps considered or accused of being a vampire. Is that true? Did it play off on ethnic differences and the outsiders?
Absolutely. Not only in America, Richard, but also elsewhere. The vampire became almost the embodiment of something which was created difficulties in the community. We talked earlier about disease coming through places like Rhode Island, through Massachusetts, through Vermont, and people looked around for a reason for that, and more importantly, somebody to blame for that, which by explaining it, they could do something about it. So you're quite right. The outsider becomes the scapegoat. For instance, taking a European example, in Albania, anyone who has even eaten Turkish food can become a vampire, because the Turks occupied Albania during the time of the Ottoman Empire and were hated. So anyone who has relations with a Turk, who has eaten Turkish food, who has washed in the same water as a Turk or something, will become a vampire. So, and if you look at a famous book like Dracula, you will see all the difficulties which faced a community. For instance, Stoker being an Irishman, we're looking at the difficulties which faced the Irish community in the late 1800s. The idea of nobility, which is where we get the idea of the nobles, because there was differences between the working class and the nobility of the time. You had the land question in Ireland, because Dracula had to sleep in his own earth, and Ireland at the time was undergoing difficulties with the ownership of land, Irish land for Irish people, and you had the difficulties with women and, dare I say, Americans. So you find all those in a book like Dracula. Read Dracula as an Irish novel rather than as a horror novel, and you'll get another layer of it. So the vampire becomes the embodiment of the difficulties of a community wherever they are. America had many scattered communities, had many diverse communities, and the vampires became scattered and became diverse in nature.
So what do you make, Bob, studying this social phenomena, the evolution of the vampire, and how it's now being portrayed in Hollywood? Initially, of course, we had vampires that were associated with disease. And pure evil, obviously. I mean, Dracula was, although there was a sort of a romantic component to it, mainly he was an evil entity. And now Hollywood has turned this on its... Everyone, you know, young girls now, they want to date vampires. What do you make of this?
That's right. And young men want to dress up as vampires and pale their faces, if you like, and become... it becomes almost a romantic ideal. It becomes a notion of... Because there is, as well as that, and we haven't touched on this, Richard, there is also an erotic component in that. And this may translate itself into the modern world, where young girls are very good-looking and are vampires, and young men are very good-looking and are vampires. And so the watered down erotic component, which it certainly is in Dracula, because if you think of it, Richard, no vampire would actually kiss you on the neck and bite into your jugular vein, because if they did, they would make one heck of a mess and you would die instantly, because that's a main artery that you're biting into. But it gives, through Hollywood, the idea of the erotic component, the wonderful kiss, which women fall immediately under the spell of the vampire or whatever, in an erotic way. So you have that component as well. And I think this is now coming to the fore, albeit in a slightly watered down way. I haven't seen any of the Twilight films, or my daughter goes to them religiously, but I'm told that young women fall under the spell of some acneed young hunk. And this is translated into some form of teenage angst. So it's now coming almost, this element is now coming almost to the fore in vampire fiction and films.
Well, granted, there were vestiges of that in even Bram Stoker's Dracula, but how, what does that say about a society that we now romanticize, dare I say, even a worship these, if you're a young girl, these vampire characters in Hollywood films? What does that say about us as a society? Because I personally find it a little disturbing.
I find it disturbing myself, and I think actually, Richard, it takes away from the core of the vampire myth. The vampire myth is made up of a whole number of elements, and we have talked about some of them. Firstly, it seeks to explain why certain things are happening. It serves to objectify, because then you can say, this is what's happening, this is what's causing it, therefore we can do something about it. And the vampire, though, you can go to the cemetery, as is, if you're reading the book in New England, they did, and dig up the corpses and pour vinegar into the cavity of their heart. So it objectifies. It also unites the community together against that. But there are other elements, and we've talked about some of them, of difficulty within the community, things like that, and such as social status, social class, things like that. And as I say, what is now happening is that one element, which is, I suppose, to appeal to young boys and young girls, has been taken out of that and has been almost amplified, if you like, through the TV series Buffy the Vampire Slayer, through the Twilight films, and I believe there are other books coming out along those lines. So they're concentrating on one aspect, but the vampire as a whole is a much, much more complex entity. It reflects also, and we haven't, we've talked about this, the cultural values of a community. And this is what I've been trying to do in the book. I'm trying to get the vampire back to its core values and back to basics.
Well, and yeah, I think you've done that quite nicely in American Vampires, which it's complete with some pretty... well, some of the vampire illustrations in here are, some of these vampires are quite attractive, but for the most part, they're suitably hideous.
Well, we had talked about it. Ian, once again, it's Ian Daniels, and Ian and I are old friends, and we had talked about it, he said, well, what do you think of vampires? And I, because he has been drawing a lot of very fairy-like women, he did some of the other books on fairies, and I said, let's keep them hideous, because they were terrifying. Remember, Richard, that you have settlers in a new place in America, set in small communities against forests, against mountains, against raging floods, on deserts and prairies, and they're trying to keep together against an unknown world. Their culture binds them together, but so do their nightmares. And it's an interesting thought that the things which we find positive bind us together, but also so do the things which terrify us. So as a community, we come closer together because we're frightened of what might be out there.
Congratulations, Bob, on American Vampires, Their True Bloody History from New York to California. And as always, a pleasure visiting with you.
And a pleasure to talk to you, Richard. And can I wish you and yours and all your listeners a very happy Christmas.
And a happy Christmas to you, my friend.
All right.
All right, that's it for me this week on The Conspiracy Show. Great to have you aboard. Hope you'll join me next week when we'll talk to a filmmaker as a shocking, very controversial new documentary out called American Empire. And I can't wait to talk to Patria Patrick. I'll be doing the show live from L.A., and we'll be sure to run into some very interesting people out there while I'm filming some more episodes for Season 3 of The Conspiracy Show. I will have an announcement soon when you can finally see Season 3. In the meantime, thanks to Tim Spreen for production. Have a good trip to Japan. I'll see you when I get back. And again, all of you listening at home, Dr. Bob Curran and Rosemary Ellen Guiley, thank you. In the meantime, don't be afraid. There's nothing concealed that won't be revealed, and nothing hidden that won't be made known. What you hear in the dark, speak in the light. What I say in a whisper, proclaim from the housetops. Move over, Aphrodite. I'm coming home.